Welcome back, Raw Thoughts listeners, to another episode with me, Mackenzie Tix. Today, I have such an interesting person. Her name is Jessica. She is a communication strategist, a video producer, a writer for the U.S. defense sector. So, Jessica, thank you so much for coming on to Raw Thoughts.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Yes, absolutely. So I want you to introduce people a little bit of what your background is. You have so many different things. I'm so interested in your background in going to Israel and what you did over there and your mental health and all of these things. So tell us a little bit just about you.
Okay, the snapshot. Okay. So I was raised in Maryland, in a small town bordering D.C., and I was born Jewish, but not religious. So like my close friends were Mormon growing up. So at age 10, my parents and my entire family as a result became Orthodox, which make it simple, just became like very religious, very involved in the Jewish world. And we moved like about 20 minutes away to a Jewish community. So from then on, I was in yeshiva, which is like a Jewish day school. And so naturally, you know, that was like coming into contact with Israel in that way. I didn't know a lot about Israel growing up, you know, when I wasn't connected to Judaism, right? So I was in high school when the second intifada broke out in Israel. And at the time, I hadn't decided to go to Israel. I was definitely interested in the security field. I wanted to join the police. I wanted to study criminology. I'd actually done an internship with the local police forces, you know, right where I grew up. And so what changed? Like, what made me want to go to Israel? So the intifada broke out and, you know, I was hearing every day in the news about these suicide bombings, these shootings, and suddenly the Israelis were not like these distant cousins. They were like, you know, like family. And it really affected me. And on top of that, we had Israeli, they weren't exactly students anymore. They were teachers who were just kind of post-military. They were in their early 20s coming to teach at our school. And, you know, they were just kind of these fun-loving guys who were like, hey, you know, you want to join the police? You want to do something for security? Why are you doing it in America? Do it, you know, in Israel. Do it for your people. And I was like, whoa, okay. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to my parents for saying, hey, you know, you're becoming an adult now at the end of high school. And, you know, you got to choose your own path. And so that was it. I immigrated to Israel in 2003. And I wish I could tell you that my path worked out smoothly and I studied criminology and worked for the police. But the reality is that I failed out of the criminology program in the first semester because my Hebrew was not good enough. I'm a bit of an impatient person. I only spent 6 weeks brushing up my modern Hebrew as opposed to my biblical Hebrew from the yeshiva days. And yeah, so I switched to English literature. I kind of let go of that dream for a little while. I switched to English literature and I loved it. And it opened up this whole world of, you know, storytelling, right? And I didn't know at the time that in the future I would be kind of melding those two things together. But yeah, it really opened up my mind. By the time I was 19, I was in a direct PhD program to become a professor. So this is not really a snapshot version anymore. I'm giving a bit of a longer version, but
that's okay. You have so much interesting. You have so much interesting things that, like, I'm going to say, not your average person does, right? Like, you are literally leaving America to go be an immigrant somewhere else, where most people are coming to America, like migrating here. So you're doing the reverse. You had said that you were going on track to be in your PhD at 19. Like, how did you even manage that?
So it was a direct PhD program. So I was invited after a semester in the program. Like, you know, obviously that was something I really loved. And I'll tell you a little secret. I actually, when I said to the university, okay, look, I just failed out of criminology. Like, you know, my Hebrew, like, isn't as good as I thought. What can I study in English? And they're like, well, there's a business program and there's an English literature program. And like business probably would have been more practical, but I was like, oh man, I suck at math. Like, I don't want to fail again. So that's the truth. Like, you know, obviously in job interviews, I'm like very polished and I make it sound like, yes, I had everything planned out, but like, no, I was an impulsive teenager and, you know, I had to make a decision. Do I come back to America to study criminology in English or do I take off a year to study Hebrew, which other immigrants have done, you know, successfully, or do I just go forward with a degree that is in English and kind of reinvent myself? So, you know, I picked option three. Yeah. at the time.
That's awesome. And it is, it's very interesting because those were your options. You could have picked one of those and your path would have been completely different. But
oh, yeah.
The path that you have chose has now came back to what you're doing now.
I know. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Somehow, some way, the universe always plays out our own story.
Yeah, I love that.
So tell us a little bit about, continue your story of being over there. You're now going through your, you know, your English literature classes. Like, what was kind of the next snapshot from there?
Yeah, so basically, this is part of my memoir, is I met a Russian immigrant in my apartment building right by the university. And this is in the Tel Aviv area. And he was about 4 years older than me. And he had immigrated to Israel when he was younger, about 12. And so he was somebody who was obviously more established in Israel, but also he was in an elite commando unit in the Israeli military. And he kind of took me under his wing as an older brother because I was obviously a clueless immigrant. And I mean, I wasn't just an immigrant, by the way. I had no adult life experience. So I had to figure out how to be an adult on the other side of the planet in a culture that's really different from where I grew up, even though there is obviously this deep connection between Jews, you know, globally. There's still, we grow up in different cultures. And not knowing the language very well in the beginning. So to have an older brother type was like amazing. It was really helpful. And as a result, I started hanging out more with his crowd. And that was the beginning of me becoming interested again in the security field, but obviously in a different capacity, not necessarily through law enforcement, but, you know, national security issues. But that was a process. It didn't happen, you know, right away. And I had a lot of struggles in between, as you know, with my mental health, things that took me by surprise. And, you know, that was a whole other journey that wound up becoming interwoven with my journey in the security field as well.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what that mental health was while you were over there.
Yeah. So I was 19 years old when I started to have the first symptoms of bipolar disorder. I didn't know anything about bipolar disorder. I didn't even know that I was like really having an issue with mental illness at the time. I don't think it is a coincidence that this started happening to me, like these symptoms, about a year after I came to Israel, because I think it was also stress-induced, which now that I know a lot more about bipolar disorder, it does make sense. So, you have the Intifada going on, right? This war that, and by the way, I just want to say, painful for both sides, both for the Israelis and the Palestinians. You know, it was a scary time. And then on top of that, I'm, you know, trying to be an adult and open a bank account and, you know, get health insurance and buy my own groceries, like everything in a language that I don't really speak that well. So it was like one stress after another. And around me, I had other immigrant friends who were around, you know, my age and dealing with a lot of similar stuff. And they were stressed out too. And like some of them were so stressed that their hair was falling out. And so I was like, oh, well, I'm acting a little weird. Like my moods are kind of weird, but yeah, it's probably because I'm stressed like everyone else. So I didn't realize right away like what was happening to me. It wasn't like this abrupt thing. It wasn't like I just woke up one day and said, oh, crap, I have a mental illness. I better deal with this. So basically what happened was, and I can just tell you like, you know, some of my symptoms, right? So I was kind of swinging between these two poles, right? that I would feel sometimes like, to be honest, amazing, like almost too amazing, like really lit up, like really creative, like writing papers all night, you know, for my English Lit program, like not really sleeping a lot, talking really fast, just being like really intense and, you know, going out at night and clubbing. And, you know, I was like this nice religious girl, but also Tel Aviv is a very secular culture. I'm having an awesome time, like clubbing and going out at night, exploring. But it was almost like too intense. And I didn't really see that. I just thought, wow, I'm an amazing person with an abundance of energy, you know? But then I would crash. And that was really rough. I would crash and I would be like sleeping 16 hours a day, like just getting up to go to school and like just being like really like suddenly like going from being completely lit up to feeling like dead inside. It was like suddenly hitting a wall, and it would go on for more than a week for sure. And like I started to feel like, oh, maybe something is like off. But I was like, yeah, maybe I'm just tired. I'm burned out. You know, I was like partying and stuff. And now I'm just tired. I have to catch up, even if the depression lasted weeks and like I'm barely eating. And, you know, I was alone. Like if my family was nearby and saw this, they would say something is wrong. We are taking you to a psychiatrist. But I was very careful what I told my parents because I didn't want to scare them. I didn't want them to tell me to come back. You know, I wanted to be this independent teenager. So, yeah, so it just continued to get worse to the point where people were noticing. And there was a particular incident where it was, you know, not just clear to others, but it was clear to me that something was wrong based on the reaction of others. I was playing, I was with some friends, a mix of Israeli and European friends at a bowling alley one night in Petah Tikva, which is a city like right next to Tel Aviv. And I was just like, I was manic and I was really intense. And like people were starting to be like, hey, like, slow down. We can't understand you when you're talking. And you're like, you're being kind of weird. You're kind of intense. And like, it really freaked me out. I just was like, whoa, like, why are you guys being jerks to me? Like, why are you saying that? Like, what are you talking? And I got really paranoid. It like freaked me out. I suddenly felt like my friends were against me. And I like they had to like talk me down. Like I ran screaming out of that bowling alley. I was really freaked out. I ran into the stairwell. I was like shaking. I was like really panicked. Like what's going on? And I didn't know if it was like my brain or my friends turning on me. You know, it's painful for me to talk about this, but I think it's important for people to hear this because in case you recognize, you know, some of those symptoms. Yeah. So basically, I will never forget this. Some of these friends lived in the same apartment building as me. And the next day, or maybe it was the next day, maybe it was sometime that week. I bumped into one of these friends in the lobby of the apartment building and she just looked at me. Nobody called me to say, hey, are you okay? Do you need to be taken to a hospital? And I'm not mad about that. Like, we're all teenagers. Like, I would have had the same reaction. Like, what the hell's wrong with this person? You know, you don't know. That's another reason why it's important for society to know more about what certain mental health issues look like, right? No blame there. But this friend of mine, like, she didn't want to talk to me. She just gave me a look like that. You know, that look like in high school in a hallway when somebody's like, yeah, and walked away.
Away from her.
Yeah, like crazy balls over there. Like, and I'll never forget that. And it suddenly, like, it was so painful. And it made me, like, super self-aware. Like, hey, if you start acting weird like this again, you got to catch yourself. You got to, like, maybe separate from people until this blows over. But that was also a turning point where I was like, I should probably see a psychotherapist. Or I don't remember if it was a psychiatrist or psychotherapist, to be honest. But it was at that point that I said, I think I need to see somebody. So I'll take a breath there. I can continue with that story or let you ask another question.
Yeah, no, keep going. I mean, I love that you're sharing these experiences because one, it's your experience, but two, through your experience, you're showing people that it's not a clear cut, like, oh, you know, you have bipolar or, oh, you know, these things are happening. And you gave a great example of, you know, everybody else was also stressed. Like I couldn't imagine going over to a whole nother country and learning how to be an adult. And so you are thinking through these things. And I love that you're sharing what your thoughts were because it's helping people that are listening understand one, it's not clear as day, and two, what your experience was so that if they maybe are, you know, feeling like their friends are turning on them, they take a second and say, hey, actually, I need to check in with myself. And I give you credit for being that young person that stopped yourself and says, hey, if this happens again, these actions that are making my friends feel like this is because of me. I need to now stop myself. So I give you so much kudos for that. So yeah, keep explaining your story because I think this is an amazing story for you to share. And then I know later we're going to get into how successful and how amazing you are while, you know, and it doesn't come easy. It doesn't come easy of understanding that you have a problem, you know, or that you have a mental illness. So yeah, keep going with your story.
Yeah. So like I said, it made me develop like this extreme self-awareness because I felt so embarrassed. I was so like ashamed by what happened in the social situation. And I can tell you that later on in my life, having that self-awareness and be able to catch myself and hide from others helped me in the security field. And I know that is a controversial issue. I totally acknowledge that. But that's another story, right? But yeah, so at this point, I said, okay, I think something is definitely different about me. This is not a normal stress reaction. I have to go talk to somebody. And oh my God, girl, the bureaucracy in Israel. I love the country so much, but the bureaucracy is like something from the Soviet era. So it was very hard for me to make the appointment to figure out the health insurance. And my Hebrew is getting better, but it was pretty rough. And like, I went through a lot of trouble to finally see. It was either, like I said, a psychotherapist, I think maybe a psychiatrist, but anyhow, I saw this Israeli psychiatrist and she listened to me and she said, you have cyclothymia. So cyclothymia, for anyone who doesn't know, it's almost like a very mild version of bipolar disorder. And instead of having like a manic episode or a depressive episode that lasts for weeks, it's something you rapid cycle throughout the day. And it can definitely be a huge disturbance in your life to go from feeling amazing to depressed, from amazing to depressed, like throughout the day. But it's definitely not as disruptive as bipolar disorder. It still requires medication and it is a potential precursor for bipolar disorder, meaning that if you do not treat it, it can expand, right, or advance into full-blown bipolar disorder, right? So basically, the psychiatrist says, well, this is what you have. And I said, well, what do I do? And she said, well, nothing. There's nothing you can do about it, which is BS. Even her attitude towards me was kind of apathetic, distracted. Like she almost didn't want to deal with it, which is very strange, but I don't know this person. I don't know what's going on in her life at the time, but like she just said, you know, this is what you have and good luck to you. And I was just like, so I went home and, you know, look, I think it's very important to listen to your intuition. My intuition told me this is not a good doctor. You should go to somebody else. But the other part of me was like, yeah, you know, she told me I don't need meds. I'm cool, man. And like the mundane truth is like, I was like a student. I was like, you know, having a good time in Tel Aviv and, you know, going out with guys. And like, I just didn't want to deal with it. I just want to deal with it. And I was just kind of told off the hook, like you're off the hook by the psychiatrist, even though deep down inside, I'm like, that's not okay. And you know what? And this is also something important that I have to share, a mistake that I made. I didn't even Google cyclothymia. I didn't look it up. If I had looked it up, if I'd understood what it really was and what it could lead to, I would have gone out there like a crusader and found another psychiatrist. So that is so important to have, not to like be Dr. Google and like Google diagnose you, but once you know that you have a diagnosis, don't just depend on your doctor. Absolutely find a doctor that you trust and your gut will tell you if this is a good doctor or not, but you need to educate yourself about your mental health issue. And that is just so important. So I didn't do that. I went on with my life. And as you can imagine, things got worse to the point where for me to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder meant me winding up in the hospital. And that sucked. Nobody wants to wind up in the hospital with that, like, because you've lost it, right? And it actually happened on my 20th birthday. So happy birthday to me. So that really sucked. But I finally had a diagnosis and I started reading about it and learning a little bit more. And I didn't delve as much as I could have into the research, but I said, okay, well, at least now I know. And I started taking medication for it and like not telling anyone. So it was very lonely, but I was like, I don't want anyone to know about this. I'm just going to like take this medication, go on with my life. And yeah, I mean, I had the ups and downs. I wound up in the hospital again because I was like, oh, I'm taking this medication. I feel great. I'm okay. I don't really have a problem. And then I would stop taking it and I'm laughing about it. But I mean, you kind of have to have a little bit of humor about this stuff or you could just go berserk. And by the way, a lot of people with bipolar disorder have done this. As a side note, when I saw this TV show, Homeland, a few years later, the actress Claire Danes, who plays Carrie Matheson, a CIA agent who was hiding bipolar disorder from the security community. It blew my mind because she did things that I had done. I was like, whoa, this is really weird. But there's like a TV character based on me, you know? Yeah, so people do that. They go off their medication and they have relapses and they wind up in the hospital and then they take their medication again. It's kind of like, I'm sure aggravating for doctors, but yeah, I had to deal with that for a few years while also doing a PhD and, you know, socially doing well and still, you know, having a lot of friends and having good times in Israel.
And I want to put in there that many people taking many medications do that. Being a paramedic and going out, like people stopped taking their heart medications. People stopped taking their antidepressants.
Oh, no.
And I mean, it's a reoccurrent thing because, right, most people in their brain say, I don't want to be on medications. I don't want to be dependent on this thing. And so what they'll do is they'll be taking the medication, and then exactly what the medication is supposed to be doing is getting them in a healthy state, and then they stop it. And then a week goes by, and then now their problems reoccur again. And this, like I said, even happens with heart medications, seizure medications. I mean, it is unbelievable the amount. And really, it's the same statement that you said, I feel good, and so I stopped taking it.
That's so interesting. Like, I didn't know that. Huh.
It's so, so frequent that people, you know, like one of the first questions, you know, people are having a seizure. I'm like, have you been taking your medication? And they're like, no, I felt good. And so I stopped taking it. And it's like, wow, you're feeling good. You're feeling good because you're taking your medication. And now these symptoms are now coming back because you're not taking it. Like this is why we take it. And so I just wanted to throw that in there that, you know, even in that aspect, you are not alone because so many people have that same mindset. So, it's very frequent.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. That's like, as a first responder, that must be pretty frustrating for you.
You go back to reoccurring people and, you know, and I have to admit myself, like I've done that on my antidepressants. I'm like, oh, I feel good. Like I can go without a day. And then, you know, you get busy and then now it's a week. And then now I'm having like crying and I'm like, why am I so sensitive? Which I'm already a very sensitive person. And it's like, oh, hey, Mackenzie, it's because you haven't taken your antidepressants in a week. And so I have recognized even within myself of doing that where it's like, oh, I feel good. Like maybe I can go, you know, a day, or maybe it's just you aren't even like cognizantly making that decision. It's just you get busy and then you forget about it. And then that kind of trickles down. And so I'm guilty of it as well. And I still know all of these facts, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you for sharing that with me. And, you know, an interesting note from what you just told me is that like when you start to feel depressed, again, because you weren't on your medication, you know, instead of saying immediately, oh man, I need to get back on the medication, you're like feeling like, why am I crying? And that's also what happened to me when I was depressed. I was like, why am I depressed? You know, because it didn't seem like, it's hard to like realize that it's something coming from you internally. And so I was like, so you look for an external thing. I was just like, well, there's a war going on. That would depress anybody. War sucks. And then I was like, or maybe I'm just having an existential crisis about, you know, my identity in the universe. Like I was like trying to figure it out. I was like really like strategizing, and I am a strategist, you know, like, where is this coming from? And I couldn't find it. And by the way, I think this aspect of mental illness really touches upon the stigma around mental illness. You know, unlike having cancer or diabetes, there is a bit of a blur between your thought processes and your personality and the mental illness. And sometimes it's hard to see where that line is truly drawn. So that's like, you know, when my friends were like, you know, something's kind of off about Jessica, they didn't say, oh, she has a mental illness. They just said, yeah, she seems a little different. So they couldn't see it either, right? Because also they're not educated in what that, you know, looks like. And by the way, when I was on my medication, people were like, oh, you know, you're like, you know, you're pretty intense, but now you're like much easier to like deal with. You know, I mean, I was a little insulted at the time, but it was like, yeah, they were reflecting back to me like, hey, yeah, now you're like a normal person. I think probably an issue I had with the medication and interestingly, in Homeland, in the TV show, you hear the character saying something similar is that instead of feeling like, well, now I'm baseline now, you know, on the medication and I'm like healthy and normal and people are reflecting that back to me, I felt like I was boring. I felt like, you know, when I was intense and manic, I was like so interesting and amazing and creative and hysterically funny. And you know, in some ways I was, but in other ways it was getting too intense. But coming down from that level of intensity to a normal baseline felt like me being boring. And that was hard for me to handle too. I didn't want to be boring, you know?
Right. Well, and you're, like you said, you're young, you're wanting to go experience all these new things and this new culture. And, you know, you don't want to be the boring person in all of that either.
Yeah.
You're like, live it up, girl, live it up.
Yeah. And you can probably tell by now that I have a very independent, you know, streak. So does my own daughter. So I'm sure she's going to give me some hell too when she grows up. And my daughter is a toddler and she is already extremely independent. But yeah, I was just like, Yeah, I was like, I don't want to be dependent on medication. I don't want to be dependent on anything. I don't even want to be dependent on a psychiatrist, you know? So that was also like a struggle that I'm now realizing, hearing other people's stories, especially from the security field, which tends to produce very independent, tough people, you know? I can see now that I started sharing my story, I started sharing it just in the last few months, by the way. Otherwise, I was super private about this. I'm now seeing the benefit of sharing this story is that other people have some similar stories and you realize you're not alone in this. And that's why I'm sharing story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I appreciate you sharing your story and why, you know, all of the guests that I have on here of their vulnerability, because it isn't until people start actually sharing what they've gone through that other people can realize that they truly are not alone. And you have expressed, you know, you did feel alone. You hid this from people. You didn't talk about it. And so even your friends in that very, you know, start of it where you had said, you know, they were reflecting you, like you were reflecting on them. Like your actions were reflecting back on how you were feeling, how you were acting and how you were, you know, projecting all of your insides to them. And when that changed, their reflection also changed.
Right.
And you were cognizant enough to realize like, hey, how they're actually, you know, perceiving this is how I'm projecting this.
Right. That's a very good way to put it. That's very interesting. And not everybody who is having episodes like with bipolar disorder are cognizant of that. There are parts of your brain, if you look into the neuroscience, that kind of turns off. So there's definitely, even though I can tell you that there are certain parts of my story with the bipolar disorder that are kind of like almost textbook bipolar disorder, except for the part of going on shopping sprees. You know, I don't have that. I wish I did. So I'd be like, oh, I'd have like awesome wardrobe of shoes. And I'm just kidding. And I'm not, you know, trying to insult anyone who's gone through the pain of having a manic episode, spending a ridiculous amount of money on a credit card and having to deal with that. But I would just say like, yeah, that's one of the symptoms that I missed out on. But so where was I going with this? So in some ways, my story with this mental illness is almost like textbook stuff. And in other ways, it is very different. Why is it different? Because for the last 10 years, I have not been on a medication and I have not had a single episode with bipolar disorder. And that's also something I want to talk about. So,
did you do that? I mean, you were in, and before that, like, I want to ask, like, you were, you know, you had said that you were in the hospital last on your 20th birthday. And then, you know, you're still going through school and managing your symptoms, managing and still being successful at the same time. How did you manage that?
A lot of hard work.
A lot.
I don't know. It was really hard. I was very lonely. It was stressful. And on the surface, like, hey, she's a great student. She's, you know, really social and she's a success story as far as immigrants go. I even had, I think it was like, maybe it was a university newspaper or a local newspaper that wanted to interview me because I was a success story. And like, people had no idea what was going on inside my real life. Like I was so stressed out that I was throwing up stomach acid. I developed an anxiety, you know, disorder also. Because I was holding so much in. It was so lonely. And I think this is an important point to make is that people in the security field who are hiding mental health issues, and I have heard this so many times, you know, when they finally break, when God forbid they commit suicide, so many people say, I didn't see it coming. I had no idea. Because these people were like performing like top of their class, top of their unit, you know, top of their station, and they're hiding it. And look, I mean, that's a tough thing. Because a lot of people who work in the security field are also, depending on your role, trained to hide things so they can hide their own tracks when it comes to their mental health issue. It doesn't mean that something isn't deeply wrong. And I've interviewed, for example, a lieutenant colonel, both from the American military and the Israeli military, and their stories were somewhat similar, that they were struggling with PTSD, they were almost suicidal, and almost nobody knew, you know? So it's possible to do that. It's possible to be high performing and to look like everything is fine on the surface. And that's the scary part is that things could be very wrong underneath the surface. And that's why somebody, as painful as it is, somebody who is suffering with a mental health issue has a responsibility to reach out to somebody, to find a trusted professional or a trusted friend, a trusted family member. Don't go through it alone.
Right, right. And yeah. I love what you said earlier too, is that, okay, you did go through, you know, the psychiatrist, but it was also your duty for yourself to continue to research that and to continue to
yes.
look into it and understand what it is that you're actually dealing with. Like the answers aren't always going to come from the people that you're trying to seek the answers from. You also have to do that work to trying to find it and learn, okay, when I get to this point, these are the actions that I need to do. Or, hey, this is a point where I can recognize that this is happening. Those are all your self duties.
And it's powerful. It's also self-empowerment, because when you find out you have a mental health issue, it can ruin your self-esteem. It really hurt my self-esteem. You know, it made me feel inferior. And even more so if you are working in the security field, which demands, you know, higher levels of fitness and intelligence and everything else. So, yeah. Sorry, remind me the question again. I'm still, I've only had a half a cup of coffee.
You're totally fine. I want you to share kind of, okay, you went through school. Now you are transitioning. How did you get into the security field? You're kind of hiding, right? You're hiding that you have bipolar, and yet you still get into the security. How did
Gosh. I don't even know where to start with that. That is, it's complicated. And obviously I talk about that in the memoir. The first thing was that I was trying to get into the military. I was trying to get into military intelligence. And this will actually weave into what was happening. How I was able to get off the medication. So they kind of coincided. So anyhow, first I was actually in graduate school. So I finished my degree in English literature. I didn't finish the PhD. I actually decided to just finish the bachelor's. Come back to the U.S. I realized that I needed a break, that I wasn't doing so well. And then I also needed to kind of figure out, you know, my next steps, my next path. So I wound up, enrolling in the security intelligence program, master's degree in Pittsburgh. So I was in Israel. I came back. I was doing, you know, that master's degree. And that was also a situation where I was struggling to get off my medication. Interestingly, I was able to get off the medication for an extended period of time, and then I crashed. I eventually crashed, and I had to go back on the medication. So I didn't exactly finish my degree, which was on purpose. I transferred my degree, and I extended it by an additional year at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. They had a political violence and terrorism department. I was, as a graduate student in Jerusalem, I was still on this medication. And there was somebody that I confided in. It was an Israeli friend. He was doing his degree in psychology. We met at the Hebrew University. We were actually set up on a date, and we decided to just, you know, be friends. And, you know, he was also kind of like a big brother type that took me, you know, under his wing. And basically, I eventually found out that he had hidden having depression and OCD from military intelligence, and he was somebody I wound up confiding in because I was very lonely, right? And he like wanted to help me. And again, I totally understand people who are like so against that, who are like, hey, that's really wrong what you did on a moral level. If you knew that you had it, it's different. Like for somebody who's in, you know, the security field and then has PTSD or anxiety from something, that is different from my cat. And I admit that, like, I'm totally open about that. It's different than somebody who knows they have an issue that might be a big problem in the security field. And my response to that, to people who criticize me for that, since I came out publicly with the story, is you're absolutely right. But yeah, if you think that's the only stupid thing I did in my 20s, like, you're going to be disappointed. You know, like, no, but absolutely. So I'm not, like, in my memoir, I'm not trying to convince people to like look at me as a hero or feel bad for me. It's just what happened. And I'm just telling people also, like, this is what I was doing. This is what I was thinking. And I actually had two distinct occasions where I was like, don't do this, walk away from this. And then I kept going. And part of it was, you know, I had this friend who was like, you know, you're worthy. You can do this just like me. You have the skills. I'll help you. And what happened? So why did I get off the medication? And again, I'm just trying to, with only half a cup of coffee in my blood right now, you know, I'm trying to bring both things together. So what happened was, I was seeing a private psychiatrist off the books. in Israel. I didn't want anything, you know, on my records that could be problematic when I go through a security clearance process. And I was getting blood tests and my lithium levels. So when you have bipolar disorder, usually lithium is like used and like this really simple salt compound that's been around for a while. That's kind of used as like a base. And then other medications like antipsychotics or antidepressants might be added to that, like Abilify, Seroquel. I'm trying to remember, it's like a while ago now, but you know, so I was taking a few of those medications, but lithium was always something that I really needed. The problem with lithium is that it can start to become toxic for you. And in my case, it was becoming toxic for my kidneys. My psychiatrist was like, I can't continue to give you lithium. And I was like, what are you going to give me then? Because like the other stuff doesn't really work that effectively if you're not giving me the lithium. And he was like, you know, I can try other like combinations, but I can't give you this lithium anymore. It's not ethical. And I was like, oh shit, you know, and this was right as I was finishing up. Well, I just finished graduate school actually. And I was working freelance jobs in the security field while I was trying to get into the military. And I was like devastated. I was like, I am so screwed. So he tapered it off very, very, very slowly. And at this point, I went back to my Israeli friend, you know, and I said, well, what should I do? And he said, look, this was like 2012, 2013. There's a lot more literature about this now. But he said, look, I'm finding some ways that you might be able to manage without medication. Let's see if this works. Okay. And if you can get off all of your medication and then go to the military, he's like, that would be amazing. And I was like, I don't know if I believe you, but okay, let's try it, because I was desperate. Like, I didn't have a choice. Right. So what did he tell me? I actually took notes on this because I was just like, I want to make sure, like, I tell people exactly what I did. It was like six things. Okay. So first of all, even now I'm a good student. Okay. So absolutely no alcohol. I can't say that I was an alcoholic, but I did have a bit of a dependency on alcohol. It was like to calm my nerves because I had panic attacks. I was really anxious. So I was like, he was like, hey, no more alcohol. And obviously it goes without saying, no drugs. I wasn't on drugs, but anybody should like hear that. Right. Don't play around with marijuana, even if it's like legal in your state. Like, don't put anything mind altering in your body, period. So that was number one. He said, you have to stop drinking alcohol, especially using that, you know, for your anxiety. The second thing was I had to get more regular sleep. I also had insomnia because my anxiety was keeping me up. I'm freaking out. He said, you cannot party all night. You need to go to sleep at the same time every night to the best of your abilities. You need to start sleeping better. Figure that out. Part of that is getting sunlight at the right time of day. So sunlight is also good in general for helping mental health issues. So I started getting more sunlight, getting it specific times of the day, usually earlier in the day. This is a big one. The next two are really big: exercise and eating right. And this just really goes for all human beings. But, you know, basically he said, you're not really in great shape. I was always skinny. I was like 5'11" and about 130 pounds. You can imagine I was like a beanpole. That's just my natural body. So I never really thought about what I'm eating. I'm like, I can eat this, I can eat that, you know, like I know a lot of women are hating me right now for saying that. So I didn't think about like what I'm eating. I ate everything I wanted to eat, including like tons of sugar because I like sugar, you know. He's like, don't eat like that anymore. He said, I'm finding research. And now, so this was 2014. It wasn't until later in 2017. I think it was 2016 with the NIH and 2017 with the American Psychological Association. They started finding real research that what you eat can definitely affect your mental health situation. So I cut out sugar. That was hard. And carbs, like really lowered how much, you know, the carbs, started eating like nutrient dense food, high, like omega-3 acids, salmon, walnuts, avocado, even taking supplements for it, like just dousing myself with nutrients and omega-3, you know, fatty acids. And again, this was like really preliminary research that my friend was digging up. It's like, now we know that this stuff really does help. So the other stuff, so that there was the eating, the exercise. He said, you need to be fit for the military, man, anyways.
Thanks, Jay.
And again, when you're skinny, you just don't even think about it, but you know, you can be out of shape and skinny. And so he's like, okay, so you're, you know, he helped me find like it was like an outdoor fitness program, you know, with these like very macho Israeli guys who just kicked the shit out of me and which I needed, you know, anyways. And like, I feel like I broke every muscle in my body, but that strengthened my body. So that was huge. That was huge. The exercise thing. And to this day, if I'm like slacking on exercise, I start to feel it, you know, it has a negative effect on me. Okay. The last thing, my notes, and I'll put my notes away. was learning to control my stress and anxiety because I realized they are bouncing off each other. Like when you get anxious, like you're not handling, and I was a bit of a perfectionist, that caused me a lot of anxiety and being like really self-critical. I'm like, dude, if you don't handle that, that is going to keep igniting your mood issues. And that's going to make you like, you can't sleep. Right. So I had to learn like how to meditate, how to stop being such a jerk to myself. You know, I had to learn all that stuff and I had to do all of that at once. And I was able to get off the medication. And it wasn't like a clean cut thing. I go off very slow. I didn't like toss it in the toilet like I did, you know, as a teenager. Very, very slowly got off this medication. I did have a relapse into a very bad depressive episode. I think it was maybe a few weeks, a month, maybe it was over a month later. And my friend got me some Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. Mm-hmm. And I was on the Wellbutrin for a few months. And then I slowly, slowly got off this. And that depressive episode, I almost decided not to go to the military. And then the military wound up calling me and saying, hey, you ready for that entrance interview? And I was just like, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't do this. And I was like, yeah, sure. I'm ready for the entrance interview. Yeah. So it is what it is. But absolutely, like, it was so important for me to share that, like what I actually did to get off my medication. And that's not going to work for everyone. There are people who will need to be on their medication for life. It is extremely rare for somebody with bipolar disorder to be able to get off their medication. And so I can't tell you like scientifically, I don't have a scientific explanation for that. I can just tell you what I did. I don't know which one of those things worked. And maybe they had to be all together to actually work. I still had that really bad depressive episode, but then I slowly got off the Wellbutrin and then I went to the military and they kicked the crap out of me for sure. Like physically, you know, it was exhausting. It was mentally stressful. By that time, I was super fit. Like Amazon woman. And I never had a relapse since then. And I can't explain it, but that's it.
My question is, have you continued all of those things still?
Yes. I'm not 100% as strict. I'll still like, yeah, I've reintroduced a little sugar, you know, have treats here. I'm not like super, super strict. But pretty like 90% of my diet has to be high, you know, density nutrient diet that makes sense. And then, you know, I still take an omega-3 acid like supplement with yogurt. I still try to eat a lot of omega-3, you know, fatty acid foods. It's been working wonders for my skin and my hair, you know. but yeah, I still like I exercise and the sleep I try to be consistent with. And it's like, yeah. So I'm not as like super strict as I was in the beginning. I've been able to like reintroduce certain foods. But like I said, now we know today, if you listen to like Dr. Andrew Huberman's podcast, he's a neuroscientist. If you dig up all this literature now, we know that these things work. So, you know, what I would say to people is like, hey, if you do all these things, which really any healthy human being should be doing, but if you're doing all these things, even if you can't get off your medication, you might be able to lower the dose of your medication and then not have such severe side effects, right? It might just be a lot better for you to do these things. And we know now from science that it does work.
The other thing is that even if you don't have a mental illness, those things are helping with your mental health. All of those things that you have just said is that even if you are not diagnosed with any mental illness, it still is our duty for ourselves to take care of our mental health, the way that we think, the way that we feel, the way that we act. All of those things with the six steps that you just said, you know, the eating, the sleeping, the exercise, all of those impact how we feel. All of those things impact how we act on a daily basis. So to the people that are listening and say, well, I don't have bipolar, I don't have, you know, depression.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you still can't do those six very simple tasks to keep yourself in a healthy mindset, in a healthy, you know, set of thinking. And that right there is mental health. Whether you have a mental illness or not, that is your mental health.
Yeah. We throw around this term self-care and like, you know, look at the security field. It's 80% male. And, you know, so it's like, you know, men can understand, for example, you know, self-care, like, yeah, I got to work out at the gym, but like self-care has many other aspects of it. And I know it's a term that's just kind of like, it's a pop term almost that like people sometimes roll their eyes around. But the thing is like, when you have a mental health issue, you have a certain vulnerability in your system. You can't deny that. So you got to do everything you can to strengthen yourself. I would also argue somebody who works in, and of course there are all different jobs in the security field. But the people who work in the very intense jobs in the security field, particularly like police officers who might not be getting great sleep because they might be on call. And you absolutely would know this as a first responder because you have probably had unusual sleep situations. You've had to be on call, right? Like, you know that, like, even more so, they have to be doing everything they can to take care of their physical and mental health. And I'm, you know, interviewing police officers now on my blog, and I've heard, you know, we live in a big country. We live in separate states, separate counties. So, you know, each police department's doing something different, but there's definitely a mental health revolution taking place. There's more awareness about it. And I've heard, for example, of several police departments who like have mandatory yoga. I do yoga too, by the way, because again, my natural propensity is to be anxious, to be very critical of myself. I have to like do that. I have to like wind down at least once, twice a week, deep meditative state, you know, self-kindness. Police officers, I absolutely agree with mandatory yoga for police officers as an example. Yeah,
it is. And you know, within, I think the security field, the military has a lot of overlay with first responders. We also have a lot of military people that get out of the military and then come into being a first responder because they have the same structure. They have the same, you know, camaraderie. There's a lot of the same routines and, you know, checking your equipment. And so a lot of the things, they overlap between those, and it doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. And even through that, you know, even through Raw Thoughts podcast, I interview so many people that are not in the first responder or the military world that still say the same things. Like, at the end of the day, we're all human. We may have a job or a career that we are more stressed from and we are more heightened from, but that doesn't change our underlying that we are all human, that we all go through this, that we all experience these things throughout time. It's that first responders and military and you, like you, the security, we're exposed to these experiences more often than the regular public. We are exposed more often to these traumatic experiences, events, even if they're not traumatic, they're stressful. You had said it, your intelligence has to be high. You have to, you're on demand 24/7. Like, you can't shut your brain off, but you have to learn how to do that. You have to learn how to be able to regulate yourself, be able to get you in a meditative state. And those are the things that, you know, really changing the mindset and the culture is going to be a long haul, because we are changing the mindset of people that have been in this for so long, that want to deny it themselves, that don't understand the power of actually regulating yourself in your mental state and that that is mental health. They think that the people that they respond to are the ones that I don't want to be like them, and so they don't say anything. Through all of that, I want you to express to us, like, how you got into that. You know, you got yourself off of the medication. You're in, you know, the military. You're doing good. You now still are doing very great, you know, within that. How have you taken that and really started to help people? Because I know that you are expanding into your memoir. You're expanding into speaking about it more often. And, you know, being that raw, that real, authentic, and willing to share person through your experience. But there's still the hard days and there's still the hard times. And you had said it in the beginning too, even speaking about it is still really hard for you. How do you manage that still with, you know, talking with people about it as well?
Yeah, well, I decided when I'm coming out with this story, and I'll tell you why, you know, it's obviously, or maybe not obviously connected to the memoir. I kind of made a promise to myself. I said, look, if you do this, you have to do this 100% and you have to be authentic. You can't BS people. Like, you really have to tell, like, people will figure that out if you're BSing them, and it will delegitimize everything else that you say. And I try, even though I'm talking about myself or my story, I try not to think so much about myself. I try to think about the value that I'm bringing to other people by sharing this story. And I know that I am, because I'm getting, like I mentioned, that I get some emails being critical of what I've done, which I don't disagree with those people. But I also get a ton of emails from people in the security field, not just in America, not just in Israel, around the world, because this is something that it's not just one country. It's a global issue. And people are like, I've had police officers, I've had guys from the Marines, like really tough people say in private messages, please keep doing what you're doing. I can never do that. And I'm thinking, like, you hunt down criminals and terrorists for a living, and it's more frightening for you to talk about mental health issues. Like, what does that tell you about the stigma? I look at the issue, like, I've also worked as a security analyst, by the way. And I look at the issue very much analytically, like there's the stigma aspect and there's the resource aspect. And both of those things have to be addressed in tandem. And it's a complex issue. There are so many different cases of mental health issues. Some people can be rehabilitated, for example, and brought back into their role in the security community. Some people cannot, and they have to be honest about themselves and not be devastated and destroyed by it. They have to see themselves, for example. And I do have a friend, my friend Roman, who I mentioned, who committed suicide when he found out that he was not going to be able to do what he wanted to do in the security field. And what I want to say to those people is, if you are as talented to get to where you got now, you are absolutely qualified to do other amazing things in your life, even if that has to be outside of the security field. So with that said, and that was obviously a huge struggle for me because I didn't want to admit, hey, you might not be a good fit for this. That's like my whole story, man, is like, you know, I was telling someone in a different interview recently, like a lot of memoirs focus, like the theme is about like finding your true self. But mine is like having to come to terms with what I'm not, you know, and that's powerful too. And that's important. So now I feel like I went off on a tangent. I'm like, what did she originally ask me? But yeah, so right, there's a memoir. And then basically what happened was I was told by literary agents who reviewed my work recently. They're like, the blog is still fairly new. And as you know, from looking at it, it's a mix of articles I've written, excerpts from the memoir, and interviews I've done, you know, with experts in the field. But anyhow, what I was told the memoir is a bit of a slap in the face, but it is what it is. Reality sucks. Sometimes they said, your story is solid. Your writing craft is solid. You don't have a name out there. You don't have followers. That's something that's expected now in the industry if we are to take you seriously and if you want like to really get out there. And I realized I am taking this seriously. And I was like, you got to go out there now, even if it's uncomfortable for you to talk about this, because if you're willing to release this in a story, in a memoir, you should be willing to talk about it now and see what happens, see how people react to that. And, you know, even with some of that criticism, legitimate criticism, there's been a lot of support, and it just shows me like, hey, keep going, man, because this is something that really would be beneficial for people.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I give you huge kudos for coming on and in speaking with, you know, my guests, because it is people like you, you know, I've said it before that you sharing your stories are helping the ones that don't have the courage yet to, and still feel alone. And even just listening to your story in the security field, in the military or not, you are helping people by sharing what your experience has been, to letting them know that you don't have to be alone, that you don't, you know, what you're feeling and what you're experiencing, you're not the only person that is going through this. And through many of these interviews, that is something that has repetitively came through, is that people feel alone. And now when they're starting to speak up, like you said, you're getting emails from people around the world. You are getting support, like through your vulnerability of sharing your story. That is where you're also getting your support. That's where you're getting your people to push you and to continue to do what you're doing, because they know it's making a difference. And there's not a lot of people that are willing to do it because they still suffer from the silence. They still suffer from the stigma. They still suffer from having that, you know, mental mentality of, I have a problem and I'm not going to speak up about it, and so everything will be fine. I'm just going to sweep it underneath the rug. And that is the problem that we are seeing. That is the problem that we are seeing that is turning into these suicides. And with the suicide numbers increasing daily, a suicide is made globally every 40 seconds.
That's so sad.
And that tells you right there, it doesn't matter your race, your ethnicity, your religion, your country. None of those things matter. doesn't even matter if it's your job, right? I know we talk a lot about the things of, I've said it, first responders, military, security, but at the end of the day, we are all human and these things affect us. And that is why I'm so grateful for you to come on and talk about your experience, because you've gone to a different country. You have lived a different culture than most of the people. And I don't even think I told the listeners, like, you're in Washington, D.C. Like, you are, the area, you know, like you are experiencing a different culture than where other people are, but people are listening also from around the world and they're not judging of saying, oh, well, it's because she lived here and this is what her background is. No, they're listening to your story because they can relate. They can take what you've gone through and maybe listen to it and said, hey, I resonate with this part of it. Hey, I need to be more aware of my feelings when my friends say, you're kind of acting a little crazy, you know? And being aware enough and not judgmental to yourself and say, hey, like, what's actually going on? Why am I acting like this? What is happening that I can fix? Because you are the one in control. And you've shown that. You've shown that through taking control over those six steps of taking control of your own life.
And it's very empowering. I think what I start to space out as I was like trying to say before my caffeine tripped out my page was that it's very empowering to fight for yourself when you realize you have a mental health issue, instead of it like ruining your self-esteem and you're like, wow, now I have to be dependent on medication and doctors and other people. You have to know you can still be dependent on yourself. You can still fight for yourself. And let that make you feel powerful dealing, you know, with this mental health journey.
Yeah. Where are you now with your work, mm-hmm. with your life and what you're doing? I know you have, you know, you're interviewing people, you have a blog up, you have a memoir. Mm-hmm. How is this all working together for you?
Yeah, sure. So, first of all, I left Israel because I wound up marrying an American and all of our family is in America. So we came back to the U.S. a few years ago, and I think I mentioned I grew up, you know, in Maryland, where I still am. And I still say that I'm a Washingtonian because I've lived in Israel. I've lived in Eastern Europe. That's, again, a whole other story. And people are like, I haven't heard of Maryland. And I'm like, okay, I'm from Washington, D.C. I will say that automatically. But anyhow, I'm in D.C., right? It's an awesome place, like international city. And so I did leave the security field for a bit. I did burn out, especially after working in Eastern Europe. And I wound up going into high tech. The high tech industry in Israel pays very well. I had my writing skills. I always had my writing skills. I was always doing that on the side to make money. I didn't know how important my writing skills would become for me later on. But anyhow, I got a job. I was working as a marketing writer. I became a video producer as well in that same company. Met my American husband, we came back, and I thought, that's over for me. And it was always a hole in my heart, like meaning I thought the security world was over for me. And it turns out that it is continuing for me just in a different way, because now I work in the defense sector, and I've done some writing in the defense sector as well, in particular interviewing leadership, creating thought leadership, was it leadership, thought leadership pieces. Yeah, doing that as well, mainly as a communication strategist and a video producer. And so kind of using this strategic and creative side of myself that is great. And so I'm still contributing to the security field. It is in a different country and it is in a very different role. And, you know, maybe sometimes I do have a little, I'll be honest, got a little jealousy of the people who are out there in the field. But I also recognize like, hey, you're also in a different phase of life. You have young children. You have to take care of your physical and mental health. So this is like, I hope that serves as like a good, like a role model thing for people who are, you know, terrified to leave their role. But you need to see that they're, you know, absolutely what you said before, the loneliness thing is really problematic, but also feeling the desperation of you can't see a path forward. That is also very dangerous, right? So I hope people can see like, hey, I've had to evolve, but now I'm in this place where I get to use the creative side, the storytelling side. And with the memoir, like, you know, yeah, so I started the blog, I admit, for selfish reasons to promote the memoir, but then it became bigger than that. And now even if the memoir is like out the door, published and all that, I would still continue with the blog. I see the service that it provides. And I learn so much from every person I interview. I feel like I just read an entire book. I learn so much from people. It's awesome. And look, when I came out, right, about my whole mental health history, which I could have easily buried, and I could have easily, you know, published my book under a pseudonym, which I realized would be a disservice. It would be sending the wrong message, by the way. I didn't know if I was going to lose my job. I'm telling you honestly. And, you know, you're talking about all the reasons that somebody in the security field doesn't want to come out with a mental health issue. That's one of them. And that's a real practical issue. I didn't know how people were going to react to me at work. I didn't know if people were going to say, give me that look like the teenagers in the bowling alley, like, I'm not working with her. It's been the opposite. I've had unbelievable support. I just have to say that to the credit of any of my colleagues who wind up listening to this. It's amazing to me, like people who actually want to help me, who follow the blog. So that's a huge blessing. I don't take that for granted. And I hope other people hear that, like, hey, if you are in the right role, in the right environment with the right colleagues, like you can come out and not have everything burned down to the ground in front of you. So I hope that's a hopeful message for people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I could continue to talk to you Dark. And hear all of your stories so much more. But while we wrap up, how can people find you and get in contact with you?
Sure. So I am on LinkedIn. I go by Jessica L. Walton. And then my blog is JessicaWaltonWriter.com. So I go by Jessica Lauren Walton as much as I can because Walton is my married name, but it's a very common American name. So a lot of Jessica Waltons out there. So yes, anybody who types in Jessica Lauren Walton, hopefully you'll find me and I'm happy to be connected.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, being vulnerable, sharing your story to enlighten, you know, the listeners of maybe what they're going through and sharing your experience and being raw with us. So all of her show notes or all of her information will be in the show notes. So definitely take a look at what she's doing, connect with her, reach out to her, read the stories. I can't interview everybody, so we've got another girl that can be able to do that as well. And I just appreciate what you're doing. I think it's so important to be collaborating with people like you and getting the message out more because just like you've said, people are scared to share their stories because of, you know, getting their jobs taken away. They feel lonely. I mean, there's so many different keys, you know, factors that you have just enlightened with us today. So I appreciate you, Jessica, and we'll talk soon, okay?
I'm more than happy to share my story. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yes, thank you, Jessica.
Thank you again for listening to another episode of Raw Thoughts Podcast. I'd appreciate it if you could follow, like, subscribe, and share with anybody that you think would be interested in this. You can also head over to my website at rawthoughtspodcast.com and see any other guests that have been on the episodes. You could also go over to Instagram and follow at rawthoughts.podcast. I would really appreciate it, and always send me a message if you're interested in being a guest or any feedback.